Good morning, Lemon Lights, both here and those of you who are joining online from home in your bunny slippers. Hello. So this morning is a little different than what some of you may have been expecting because, first of all, because of next week, this week was supposed to be contemplative and we weren't supposed to have communion and I wasn't supposed to be on the worship team. But if you look over there, you're not going to see Catherine Anderson here today. So basically, I'm doing what I want. So, take a walk on the wild side. But we will still begin the service with our Lenten liturgy, where we're using art and devotional readings that speak to resisting empire. And our topic for today's reading is rejecting violence and embracing peace. This mural that's right there, it's painted by the British street artist Banksy. I think I've used one of his paintings before. And it's located in Lebanon. Banksy maintains strict anonymity, utilizing satire and dark humor to deliver anti-authoritarian messages in public spaces globally, from London to Palestine and elsewhere. He uses stencils to enable him to paint quickly and stealthily. Now, there's a concerted effort gone into identifying his real identity, and I believe they've actually solved it, but it was his desire to remain mystery. And so I'm going to leave that there and allow him to at least be anonymous here this morning. I'd like to respect his wishes. This picture, painted on a wall in Lebanon, speaks for itself. The term liturgy finds its origin in the Greek words for people and work. It includes the labor of a community alongside the prayers, the meditations, and rituals that shape us as we gather together as a people of God. As we walk through the Lenten season, we're taking a few moments each week to participate together in liturgies for resisting empire, much as the prophets of old did. We hope that these prayers help to collectively tune our hearts to the heart of God and the prophetic work that our present day and age requires. By empire, we mean any political, economic, or even religious system that requires power, fear, and the exploitation of others to exist. As we see throughout history and in our present day, this way of empire inevitably leads to domination, division, and isolation, rather than shared belonging, flourishing, shalom, and peace of the kingdom of God. As I offer this week's prayers from the Cuban-American author and theologian Kat Armas, you're invited to join me in a responsive reading of the text, and your part will be in bold, and to share a moment of contemplative silence in response to a short parable. So let's pray. God of the cosmos, you who dwell in the vastness and the dust, remind us of our place in a world marked by systems of violence. Uncover in us the roles we play and open our hearts to the work of unmaking what harms. We say together, we are here to listen, to learn, and to act with compassion and love. The people of Japan tell a story about an old man and a samurai. In a small village nestled between the mountains, there lived an old farmer named Hiroshi. His community had long been plagued by conflict, feuding with nearby villages over land and resources. One day, a powerful samurai rode into the village. He offered to teach the people the art of war so they could protect themselves from future threats. Many villagers were eager, believing violence would bring peace. But Hiroshi stepped forward. Samurai, he said, I ask for a day to show you a different way. Curious, the samurai agreed. The next morning, Hiroshi invited him to walk through the rice fields. Together, they saw the stalks bending under the wind's force, but never breaking. See how the rice endures by yielding, Hiroshi said. It survives not by fighting the storm, but by moving with it. At noon, Hiroshi served tea in silence. The samurai watched as Hiroshi poured the tea slowly, never rushing, allowing for a time of reflection. True strength lies in stillness and peace, Hiroshi whispered. The samurai, moved by the simplicity and the wisdom of Hiroshi's ways, abandoned his plans for war, realizing that peace, like the rice stalk, bends but never breaks. Those who have ears, let them hear. I'd like to spend a minute or two in silence as we look at Banksy's picture and see what it might say to us. Divine rest, we confess the ways we have turned away from peace, the times we've chosen silence when justice called. Forgive us, O beloved, for forgetting our belonging, for thinking we are not enough, for thinking we are not alone. Grant us the courage to embrace one another, to walk toward the peace that makes space for all. Let our hearts beat with the rhythm of unity. For in your peace, we find our true home. And we say together, we reject the violence of empire and embrace the peace of Christ. May we be filled with a strength that rises not from the clash of arms, but from quiet courage. Let us hold the weight of love like an offering, knowing that true power lies in the gentle persistence to heal, to soften, to mend what is broken. In the tender pursuit of peace, we find the resilience to endure, to breathe, and to be. Amen. So, as you probably recall, in the current Lenten season, the teaching team is focusing on prophets, using Richard Rohr's book called The Tears of Things as a reference. I was slated to do the contemplative service, as I said, but have a particular liking for one of the prophets, so I called an audible and decided to do a regular message instead. For those of you who enjoy the contemplative services, my apologies. For those of you who prefer regular format, you're welcome. I know that at least some of you are happy. Richard Rohr's book touches on various prophets, digging rather deeply into most of them. But there are some that he lumps into one category, which he refers to as unfinished prophets. These are prophets whose stories, in his estimation, remain somewhat unfinished. In other words, they're not tied up neatly with a bow. You know, the Bible does that. It doesn't always tell us the whole story, right? I mean, think of the rich young ruler. He tells Jesus of the laudable works that he's done and his acts of righteousness, and then he asks what more he should do. And Jesus responds he should sell all his possessions and give the proceeds to the poor. And the rich young ruler leaves, and his heart's heavy, and he's despondent because he's quite wealthy. And there it ends. We don't know what the rich young ruler thinks on his way home, do we? I mean, maybe as he's walking, he's arguing with himself both sides of the question and decides it's worth it and sells all his stuff and then follows Jesus. Or maybe he goes home and he continues in his wealthy ways, but what Jesus says stays with him. And after a few years, he begins to use his wealth to help other people who are more disadvantaged. Maybe not. We don't know. Have you noticed that God rarely asks people in the Bible to surrender stuff that they don't care about? It's probably the same with us, really. It always seems to be something dear and precious, something that God may even have promised, like Abraham being asked to sacrifice Isaac. But back to the rich young ruler, I really like the story wasn't finished. It allows us our own time of wrestling with the Isaacs that God asks us to lay on our altar. Well, this week's prophet, Elijah, is one that Roar places in the unfinished category, and honestly, far be it from me to disagree with Richard Rohr because he's smarter, wiser, and way more holy than I. But I wish I could ask him why he put him in this category, because Elijah's, his stories are found in the books of 1 and 2 Kings, and there's like 8 chapters about his life. And it begins at the beginning of his ministry, and it ends when he mysteriously exits in a chariot of fire. So the story seems pretty complete to me, at least at first glance. But maybe not. We'll see. Because it's 8 chapters, I'm going to summarize the passage rather than read it. And somehow I don't think you'll mind, or you'll still be here next week. So Elijah is introduced as a prophet from Tishbe. We first encounter him when he confronts King Ahab, who ruled the northern kingdom of Israel somewhere around 874 to 853 BC, who the Bible describes as doing more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any king before him. Wow, what an epitaph. He was known for actively promoting Baal worship. Ahab, not Elijah. I should make that clear. So Ahab was known for actively promoting Baal worship under the influence of his wife Jezebel. You may have heard of her. Not a nice lady. I tried to find a picture of her, but they were all cheesy, so there's no picture of Jezebel. Ahab built a temple for Baal, and Jezebel brought a large entourage of priests and prophets of both Baal and Asherah to the country. In this context, Elijah is introduced only as the Tishbite, so we don't know much about him in his early years. And you'll notice from the map of Tishbe, or that Tishbe is a good ways away from where Ahab and Jezebel lived. So, you know, Elijah could have stayed happily at home and kind of ignored the whole thing, but that's not our boy. He made his way from Tishbe to Samaria, where he denounced Ahab for abandoning Yahweh. To underscore this message and give it some credence, he predicted a catastrophic drought and famine that would last over 3 years, a drought so severe that not even a drop of dew would form, all because Ahab and his beautiful queen stand at the end of a line of kings of Israel who have said to done, who have been, can't talk this morning, who are said to have done evil in the sight of the Lord. And sure enough, the drought came, and it was severe beyond belief. When Ahab confronts Elijah, he denounces him as being the troubler of Israel. But Elijah retorts that Ahab himself is the one who troubled Israel by allowing the worship of false gods. And Elijah then challenges Ahab to put it to a test, or a duel, if you will, and settle the controversy of whose God is bigger and stronger once and for all. Ahab takes the bait. At Elijah's instruction, Ahab summons all the people of Israel to be witness, and also summoned 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah to Mount Carmel. Now, look at Mount Carmel. I mean, can you imagine them up at the top where everybody could see them? This is going to be dramatic. And I think Elijah's a little bit excited. So Elijah berates the people for their acquiescence in Baal worship. And he says, "How long will you go limping with 2 different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." Elijah proposes a direct test to the powers of Baal and Yahweh. He and Baal's prophet will each take 2 bulls and prepare it for sacrifice in their way and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. The prophets of Baal choose and prepare a bull accordingly, and Elijah invites them to pray for fire to light the sacrifice. Well, they pray from morning to noon, no success. Elijah begins to ridicule their efforts. At noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, "Cry aloud. Surely Baal is God. Maybe he's meditating. Or maybe he wandered away. Or he's on a journey or vacation. Or perhaps he's asleep and you need to awaken him." So they responded and they began shouting louder and louder and began slashing themselves with swords, spears, knives, and sickles. They continued praying at the top of their lungs until evening with no success. During this time, Elijah is repairing the altar that was up on Mount Carmel that was to worship Yahweh. He repairs it with the 12 stones that represented Israel's 12 tribes. He digs a trench around the altar and prepares the other bull for sacrifice. He then orders that the sacrifice and the altar be drenched with water from four large jars, poured three times each, which filled the trench. Elijah asks Yahweh to accept the sacrifice, and fire falls from the sky, consuming it, the stones of the altar itself, the earth, the water, and the trench, including the water as well. When the people saw this, they declared, "The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God." Elijah wins. Or maybe Yahweh wins. But the victory went straight to Elijah's head. Still filled with semi-righteous anger at the Israel's defection from the one true God, plus an enormous jolt of adrenaline, I would imagine, Elijah then orders the Israelites to seize the prophets of Baal and Asherah, which they do. They bring them down to the river Kishon, and every one of them is slain. What about the drought, you ask? Well, Elijah, probably still drenched in the blood from Baal's finest, remembers. He then tells Ahab to leave because it's about to rain. Sure enough, a small cloud appears, and shortly after, the rain falls in torrents. Well, the people may have turned back to God, but not so much Jezebel. She's pretty ticked off that all her prophets have been butchered, and she pronounces that she will surely kill Elijah before the next day arises. Elijah's bravado suddenly evaporates, and he flees in fear. He ran from Mount Carmel to Beersheba in Judah. Then he traveled a day's journey into the desert, and depleted of energy, he came to a small bush. He sat down under it. He prayed that he would die. "Lord, I've had enough," he said. "Take my life. I'm no better than my people of long ago." And then he lay down under the bush, and he fell asleep. Suddenly, an angel touched him, and the angel said, "Get up and eat." Elijah looked around. Near his head, he saw some bread. It had been baked over hot coals. A jar of water was there also. So Elijah ate and drank. Then he lay down. Strengthened at last, he leaves the desert and goes to Mount Horeb, where he finds a cave and takes shelter in it. Here God meets him, and this I will read from 1 Kings 19:8 to 18. Elijah kept going until he arrived at Mount Horeb. It was the mountain of God. There he went into a cave and spent the night. A message came to Elijah from the Lord, and he said, "Elijah, what are you doing here? Does that remind you of the Garden of Eden? Adam, Eve, where are you?" Anyway, he replied, "Lord God, who rules over all, I've been very committed to you. The Israelites have turned their back on your covenant. They have torn down your altars. They've put your prophets to death with their swords." Note that. They have put your prophets to death. "I'm the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me." And the Lord said, "Go out. Stand on the mountain in front of me, because I'm going to pass by." As the Lord approached, a very powerful wind tore the mountains apart. It broke up the rocks. But the Lord wasn't in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord wasn't in the earthquake. After the earthquake, a fire came, but the Lord wasn't in the fire. And after a fire, there was only a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his coat over his face. he went out and stood at the entrance to the cave. Now, I realize that this picture is not the entrance to the cave, but isn't it peaceful? Can't you imagine God whispering? So I picked that. Then a voice said to him, "Elijah, what are you doing here?" And then God encouraged Elijah, giving him instructions, but also telling him that there were still 7,000 people in Israel who have not and will not bow their knee to Baal. Well, other things happened to and through Elijah, miraculous things, weird things. But I want to talk about Elijah's weak point and how God confronted it on Mount Horeb. See, things happened when Elijah spoke. Did Elijah do them? No, of course not. He couldn't do that. He didn't have superpowers. He was fully human, just like us. And he reacted probably like we would have. I mean, think of it. The showdown at OK Corral up there on Mount Horeb, or Mount Carmel, sorry. Elijah stands alone with a soggy, wet offering against 400 prophets of Baal, whose contorted dancing and gyrations were meant to induce Baal and Asherah to rain down fire from heaven and show that pesky prophet of Yahweh what was up. But no matter how they gyrated, no matter what histrionics they practiced, what happened? Big, fat nothing. And the more nothing that happened, the more pumped up and full of confidence Elijah got. He was going to show those 450 prophets what was what, and he would get the last laugh when God opened up a can of whoop-you-know-what on them. So he got caught up in his own emotions, yelling at the prophets of Baal, "Maybe Baal's asleep. Yell a little louder," and other taunts and jibes. And then when it was his turn and God showed up in a flash of fire and consumed Elijah's offering, showing the Israelites once and for all who was God, wouldn't that go to your head? In Elijah's defense, who wouldn't? And to culminate the occasion, Elijah rounded up the prophets of Baal and instructed the Israelites to put them to sword in a mass slaughter. No doubt, amidst the carnage, Elijah accepted the accolades of the masses, and I can hear them. "Good job, Elijah. You really showed them we're going to follow your God now." It was a great day for Elijah. But then there was the evening and the morning, and a new day dawned, and reality sunk in the form of Jezebel, who was not saying, "Good job, Elijah." Rather, she was, in our day's cultural vernacular, pissed. She said, "Elijah, I'm going to slaughter you this very day like you did to my prophets, if it's the last thing I do." And something in her tone made Elijah believe her. So he ran, and he ran, and he ran some more. Finally, he ended up out in the desert and prepared to die, not by Jezebel's hand, but due to lack of food, water, and shelter. In fact, he asked God to kill him. And based on the outcomes of his previous prayers, I assume he thought that would happen. So he curled up beneath the bush and went to sleep, not expecting to wake up. But when he did wake up, it was to find that angels had left bread and a jug of water to strengthen him, not once, but twice. And at that point, he followed their instructions and made his way to Mount Horeb, where he found a cave, and there, God showed up for the teachable moment. So let's put a pin in that for a sec. Now, I've been a church gal for most of my life, and I've heard a bunch of sermons on Elijah and all the bells and whistles and the fire and the brimstone. That was usually the focal point. It seems from reading the passage that those were the focus of Elijah as well. Some variant of "my God is bigger than your God, neener, neener, neener." But when the fire and brimstone stopped falling, I think Elijah recognized his own frailties. I think he was terrified. I think he knew he overplayed his hand. He knew it was God's power that had been on display, not his, and he felt incredibly vulnerable, having painted a huge target right on his chest, and all Jezebel's wrath was focused right on the bullseye. So I want to tell you a story about someone I know. He was a young man, and he was in high school, and he was grappling on whether or not God truly existed. And somehow, it was one of those moments where God put his hand over my mouth, because I was steeped in the evangelical tradition, and I had all the answers, and I could have argued him right into the, well, he became a lawyer, so I couldn't have, but I thought I could. But God told me to be silent. And so I said to him, that is a really important thing to wrestle about, possibly the most important thing you will ever wrestle with. So he asked me to pray that God would show him a sign or something truly remarkable so that he might believe. Probably at one point or another, we've all done that, right? I know I have. Well, I prayed what he asked me to pray, and nothing happened. And he prayed, and nothing happened. And pretty much, God was silent. And he got really discouraged. So did I. And he got jealous and probably a bit suspicious of his Christian friends who were reporting miraculous signs and wonders that they had experienced. One day in prayer, I had an impression that God was telling me that God would vastly prefer that this young man would listen to his whispers rather than the bells and whistles. Hearing God's whispers. Now, what does that entail? Well, several things. First of all, a quiet and a receptive heart. It's hard to hear God's whispers, whatever form that takes, if we don't slow down. I have this image of the American Christian's way of following God, and it looks like something like the one on the left. We run our own way, and God is frantically trying to chase us down. I can't imagine this is how it was intended to be. I think it was more likely to be like the picture on the right, us running towards God. The Bible is full of phrases that touch on that theme. Come to me, return to me, follow me, turn to me, slow down, breathe, quiet your heart, and receive. Well, second, it requires a posture of listening rather than asking. My prayers have evolved a lot since I began this journey. I started with rote prayers. Now I lay me down to sleep. God is great. God is good. Got a gold ribbon on a Sunday morning because I'd finally learned to recite the Lord's Prayer. And then, thanks to some rather bad teaching, I began to see God as the ultimate heavenly Santa Claus. And my prayers devolved into a Christmas wish list. Oh God, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? Or a pony? Or a new Barbie doll outfit, or make that cute boy like me, stuff like that. In his wisdom and grace, God did not give me the desires of my heart. I was well into adulthood before it occurred to me that prayer was listening rather than talking. It was a posture of putting myself in God's presence and then basically shutting up. That kind of prayer tends to yield results. Not a pony, not a Mercedes, but rather a quiet heart and a transformed life. Next, it involves a release of expectations. I love Shakespeare, and I agree with him on many things, but especially this. Expectations is a foul word in my house. Expectations can ruin things if we let them. My mother-in-law has spent many an occasion in disappointed misery because something didn't go the way she expected it would. So she missed out on the blessings and joy of what was actually happening around her. We need to release our expectations when it comes to God, because God pretty much never comes the way we expected him to or the way we think he should. And last, surrender. Yielding and surrender are very hard for me. I lead with an Enneagram 5, which means I'm a big picture person. Things are well researched and thought out. And in my mind, my conclusions are pretty much the way things ought to be. I think of things from my... except there's a slight flaw to that. I think of things from my perspective alone. I can't help it. We all do. which means any conclusion I come to is skewed in my own direction and very likely for my own benefit. So the wise move is, if you remember war games, not to play. And yield to a God who sees things from a totally different, wider, and greater perspective than I will ever be capable of holding. And then, surrendering to God's greater wisdom. It sounds like a no-brainer when you put it like that, right? And yet, despite all my years of failed attempts, I still think I have a better way, or at least that it's the way I tend to live, even though I might profess otherwise. Surrender, the strong move, the wise move, the best and highest move for any of us. Well, okay, enough rabbit trails, although that particular rabbit trail happens to be sort of the meat of the message. But let's get back to the cave at Mount Horeb. God instructed Elijah to come out of the cave and said that he would pass by. And once Elijah left the shelter behind and stood at the mountain of the cave in vulnerability, the Lord approached. But the very powerful wind arose and it tore the mountains apart, even breaking up the rocks. I should have had a picture from, I think it's The Hobbit. Where is Andrew when I need him? Where the mountain of, it starts with a C, there's a mountain in either The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings where the mountain's being torn apart by rock people. Remember, please? Okay, anyway, don't tell Andrew. This stays here. Anyway, the Lord wasn't in the wind. And after the wind, there was a powerful earthquake, but the Lord wasn't there either. And then a fire came, but the Lord wasn't in the fire. Now let's think of our own lives and our own senses of vulnerability. Think of the winds, the hurricanes that can knock down buildings. Think of the earthquakes that can knock down bridges. Think of the fires that can burn our homes. These are terrifying images. They're dramatic. God wasn't in them. Finally, after the fire, there was only the gentle whisper when God said, "Elijah, what are you doing here? Why are you running away? Don't you trust me?" It's sort of like God was saying, "Yeah, there was a lot of crazy things that happened there on the altar. And yeah, I sent them. But that's not how I want to meet you. I want you to approach me with a quiet and a receptive heart, with a posture of listening rather than asking. I want you to release your expectations of me because I don't always do what you think I'm going to do. And I want you to come to me in surrender, in humility, and weakness so that I may be strong for you. A quiet and receptive heart, a posture of listening rather than asking, a release of expectations and surrender." Well, if you want to read a wild story, keep reading in 2 Kings. It's crazy. And if you don't mind the spoiler alert, it culminates with Elijah being taken up to heaven in a chariot of fire, which I don't understand at all. So I will let you draw your own conclusions. It either happened or it didn't. If it did, it was weird. And I have no explanation for it, so I will not offer one. Honestly, I don't know, or I don't think at this point of the story of Elijah at all. And I want to challenge you to read it, but to get past the bells and the whistles that we've all heard about, the earthquake, the wind, the fires, because that's not how God generally works. And if that's what you're waiting for, you may have a long wait. Like the young man who asked me to pray for him, you will likely find that God speaks in silence rather than cacophony. He whispers a lot. And when that doesn't get your attention, he will raise his voice. But sometimes that's not as comfortable as his whispers. In fact, my prayer these days is, "Lord, help me to attend to your whispers, to your quiet indoor voice, so you don't need to raise it." Elijah loved the drama of God's mighty acts. I mean, who wouldn't, really? But there's a danger there, and I think Elijah fell into it. the danger of worshiping what God does for us rather than worshiping God alone for who God is. And then there's the issue of motivation. Where did Elijah's zeal come from? From a righteous indignation that people were rejecting Yahweh in favor of Baal? Yeah, it probably started there. But then he got stuck in his anger. Like Jeremy talked about last week, the anger became a shield for what Elijah was really feeling, a profound sadness that Yahweh was being rejected in favor of a charlatan, a grief that God's chosen ones were choosing someone else. It is sad. It's tragically sad. But it looks to me like Elijah didn't take the time to slow down, but rather acted out of his anger and frustration, and then got caught up in the bells and whistles and the fire and the brimstone, and forgot that that is only one element of God, and probably not God's chosen way of interacting with his beloved children. Allow yourself the favor of slowing down, seeing what's behind your anger, and spending time with that emotion. And if you didn't listen to Jeremy's message last week, I'd like you to take some time this week and listen to it, because it's solid gold. Well, we began this morning with the liturgy for resisting empire. And these days, there's an awful lot of noise going on. A lot of violence, division, hatred, war, fear. And it's tempting to meet those things with noise, violence, and hatred of our own. It's tempting to join the protest marches and get caught up in the hate speech and let anger overcome you, feeding off the anger of the mobs. I picked this particular picture, which you will recognize as the backdrop to Do You Hear the People Sing, singing the songs of angry men from Les Mis. And I picked it purposely, as opposed to the many images I could have taken from the news, because I wanted this message to be more universal than specific to a current cause or issue. That does not mean that today's issues are not important. They are, and vitally so, as is our part in them. But sadly, those issues are not new. And the protests of today, born from the protests of yesteryear, will most certainly give rise to the protests of tomorrow. Now, let me be clear. I'm not against protesting or protest marches. But I think there is a cautionary tale that we can learn from Elijah. Don't get caught up in the noise. Protest if you want, but not from hate. Protest because the love in you for others wells up and will not be silent. Protest from love, with love, for love. I want to end today's message the way it started, a lesson from a rice farmer given to a mighty warrior. It is a variation, a child using a rifle as a flower vase. It is the heart of beating swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks. May it be our heart as well. See how the rice endures by yielding, Hiroshi said. It survives not by fighting the storm, but by moving with it. At noon, Hiroshi served tea in silence. The samurai watched as Hiroshi poured the tea slowly, never rushing, allowing time for reflection. True strength lies in stillness, in peace, Hiroshi whispered. The samurai, moved by the simplicity and wisdom of Hiroshi's ways, abandoned his plans for war, realizing that peace, like the rice stalk, bends but never breaks. The still small voice of God whispers a better way in our ears if we listen. And our own still small, very small voice can speak peace into a storm. It can speak comfort and hope and love into cacophony. It can search for peace amidst chaos, beauty amidst ashes, and flowers amidst the storm of gunfire. Well, today is communion, and I was wondering as I was considering what to say, what might the disciples have been thinking during that Last Supper? Here they are coming fresh from the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, watching the crowded streets rise up in accolades to Jesus as the conquering hero who would soon overthrow Rome. Some of them believed that to be true. Others were unsure because one thing they knew of Jesus, he never did what he was supposed to do. And if you have not learned that, take that home with you. And now, in a quiet room, as they prepared to celebrate the Passover, he took off his outer robe and began to wash their feet. This is no way for a conquering hero to act. No doubt there was confusion, and confusion breeds unsettledness and fear. And when one is destabilized by fear, other emotions rise to the surface to protect what's going on deep inside. So there was probably some anger. Wait a minute, what? Someone's going to betray Jesus? Well, it sure as heck isn't me. And suddenly everyone looked at everyone else with suspicion, so much so that they didn't notice Judas slipping away quietly to do the things that they were so intent on not being suspected of doing. But Jesus seemed unperturbed, and instead, he picked up a loaf of bread and broke it and passed it to his left and right, saying, "Take and eat. This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." His body, broken, brings wholeness to the brokenness of those around him. Then he picked up the cup and he gave thanks and he said, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, shed for you and for all people for the forgiveness of sins. Do this in remembrance of me." All people. At what point did we decide that only some people receive forgiveness and grace from Jesus? How can we unlearn that and begin to see everyone, as God sees them, as his beloved? Jeremy teases me about a time when I suggested that you all take a look at Adolf Hitler's artwork, because he didn't think that was something that normally went into a sermon, and it may not be. But the interesting thing is this, the artwork actually is quite lovely. And the same container that held that artwork contained the Holocaust. We also have multiple containers in us. Hopefully not that extreme. But we need to learn to see everyone with the grace that God gives us. I would like to end with a benediction taken from the liturgy that we began. And if we could have the ushers and the worship team come up. God of the cosmos, you who dwell in the vastness and the dust, remind us of our place in a world marked by systems of violence. Uncover in us the roles we play and open our hearts to the work of unmaking what harms. Help us to listen to your whispers, to learn from your Son who shows us how to be in this world, and to act as he acted with compassion, grace, forgiveness, and above all, love. When you're ready, come forward for communion, up these aisles, down that way. That way we don't have a traffic jam. Works lovely. When you leave, there's a cart outside for the cups. As Jeremy said, all are welcome to the table. All are invited to receive, no matter who you are or what state your heart is in this morning. Jesus said, "Are you tired, worn out, burned out on religion, burned out on something else? Come to me. Get away with me and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me. Work with me. Watch how I do things. Learn the unforced rhythm of grace. Keep company with me and you'll learn to live freely and lightly. So come. Come as you are. Come as you aren't. Come as you were. Come as you one day will be. But come."